aspects of identity-based encryption. So in this talk, there are a number of different, I will bring together a number of different things from the pairings to the algorithms and to actual deployment issues. So I would like to give you a brief outline of what I will be talking about. So I will discussing practical deployment things. We need to understand what the issues are, and that's where the crypto will come into play. And the crypto itself is also rooted in the elliptical mathematics, which is why we have this outline. So first, the what and the why of the problem that we want to address is that the purpose of identity-based encryption is to communicate securely, for instance, via email, based on actual names, for instance, alice@gmail.com, which hopefully doesn't exist, rather than, for instance, this key which we have to create and manage and also bind to the actual user. So what IB brings is that they remove the need for certificates, because whereas a certificate was needed to bind this an email address to this awful public key in the previous slide, with identity-based encryption, the identity is supposed to be the public key itself. So the binding is the identity function, so we don't need to actually provide it explicitly. So one consequence of that is that there's no certificate management issues to deal with. In particular, there's no revocation list, and so actually there's a little caveat here that in order to achieve no revocation, what we have to do is that we have to make the private keys sufficiently short-lived that they will expire before we would actually have to revoke them. So we simply would not issue a new key if a key has been revoked. And the trick that was originally proposed by Monet Franklin to do that is simply to put some sort of timestamp on the identity. So that's easy. And then the third consequence is that there's no pre-enrollment. That means that if I want to send you an email, I can do it without you having to start to generate a key pair and publish an authenticated version of a public key on the web where I can find it and things like that. So to see what this means in a deployment, so in a traditional PKI-based system, say alice@domaina.com wants to communicate with bob@b.com, then there needs to be a certificate authority somewhere in the sky. And Bob has to generate a key pair, send the public key to the signing authority to get the certificate back. And then this certified public key has to be published somewhere where Alice can find it, and then can use that to encrypt an email. Actually, that's not quite all, because in a corporate environment, if Bob is an employee at companyb.com, it may be important that Bob's emails be readable even after Bob leaves or whatever. So we need an escrow mechanism, a recovery server to store Bob's private key. So with IBE, things are much simpler, because we don't need either the certificate server nor the recovery server, and the IBE key server kind of plays the role of the certificate authority. So that's kind of what we want to achieve. So now I will step I'll take a big step back, and we'll start from how to get there. And we know that we can realize pairings. We can realize IBE based on pairings. So that's I will start with a brief history of pairings. I will not say too much about that to this audience, of course. So in crypto, a big favorite is to do crypto in groups where the discrete log is hard, because things are very convenient to work with, and a lot of things that can be done in provable security and a lot of constructions that are interesting. In particular, elliptic curves are very appealing for a number of reasons, which I will not get into. And one of these particular reasons is that they are equipped with bilinear maps, which on certain curves can be used can actually be computed efficiently. And that started with the definition of the veil pairing in 1946. And there have been a number of, I mean, then we have an algorithm was proposed to compute it efficiently, then an attack based on it was then proposed, and then a few years later, one started to realize how they can be used in a constructive way. And IB is the poster child of those constructive ways at this time. So this slide is just there for the notation. So I apologize for if you are more used to the additive notation for points and groups. But since I'm going to mostly focus on abstract groups, it kind of makes more sense to use the multiplication notation to describe the pairing groups. So some consequences, some really immediate consequences of the pairing are that we have a discrete log reduction from the base group to the target group. So that's the basis of the MOV attack in certain elliptic curve cryptosystems. And the second consequence is that the pairing provides a decision procedure for the Diffie-Hellman problem, at least in certain cases. So if we want to use those pairings in cryptography, we need to somehow deal with these vulnerabilities, and actually even better, we eventually want to exploit those things. And that's where the notion of gap bilinear groups come into play, and there's this new class of gap assumptions where of which the most minimalistic example is the gap Diffie-Hellman, which says that the computational Diffie-Hellman problem, which is to compute g to the ab given g to the a and g to the b, should remain hard even given an oracle for the decision Diffie-Hellman problem. And of course, we know that the pairing provides such an oracle. It provides more, but in particular, it provides such an oracle. The thing is that we cannot do much with the gap Diffie-Hellman assumption by itself. So an assumption that has proven to be quite useful is the bilinear Diffie-Hellman, which it essentially generalizes the CDH and the DDH assumption in a way that they remain hard even in the context of the pairing. And the way this is done is to use three sequence exponents instead of two, and also moving the Diffie-Hellman operation to the target group. Because what happens is that the pairing essentially gives us a way to compute one Diffie-Hellman operation moving from the ground group to the target group. So with two exponents we could compute it, with three we can't. At least we believe that we can't. And there have been many other assumptions that also have been proved quite useful. And so it's actually useful to try to give a rough sense of what all those assumptions mean, because if you follow the literature on pairing-based cryptography, you see all those papers with making new assumptions all the time, and sometimes putting existing assumptions to different uses and things like that. And to see what the practical implications are, it's a kind of useful to see what kind of assumptions can be made. It also has relevance to the notions of exact security. So the first assumption, which I already talked about, is this is the BDH, and we can also consider the tripartite Diffie-Hellman, and those are kind of the obvious generalization of CDH that one can think of. And they provide blinding or encryption, and so one would use them as one would expect. Then there's the strong Diffie-Hellman assumption, which I'm not going to describe it to you in detail, but if you know a little bit what it is that the idea is that it has it just like the strong RSA assumption that came before. The idea is to provide exponentially many hard solutions, so that even if the adversary gets to see a lot of those solutions, finding new solutions will still be believed to be a hard problem. And the strong Diffie-Hellman has not really, been really useful for IBE. It has been useful in other schemes, but not really for IBE. But it's kind of related to another class of assumption, which is this whole Diffie-Hellman inversion of, or bilinear Diffie-Hellman inversion assumptions, which also which kind of sit somewhere in between those two assumptions, in that just like the strong Diffie-Hellman assumption, they provide a lot of data to the adversary, but only admit a single solution, just like the BDH, which generalized CDH. So I guess those two assumptions have been quite useful for pairing-based constructions, for IB constructions. Then I should also mention the linear assumption, which provides a kind of a full substitute for DDH that withstands the pairing in the base group. The BDH assumption does not quite do that. It works in the it involves the target group, which the linear assumption really does not. And it is useful to create for hiding things like in zero knowledge proofs and things like that. And a new funny assumption, which involves actually pairings on composite order groups, has also been used. It's kind of similar in its use with to linear, although the idea is completely different, and it's also used for hiding. So the assumptions that we've seen so far in pairing-based cryptography kind of fall more or less into these categories, and I guess number one and number three are really the ones that have been useful for IBE, and perhaps also a little bit number four in certain cases. So a parenthesis is that what one can ask is, why are there so many assumptions? Well, could we do with a single pairing assumption, whatever that is? Well, the problem is that which one should we pick? If it's too weak, it's going to be useless. For instance, we can simply assume that the pairing is non-invertible for some suitable definition of non-invertibility. That will not get us very far. Or we can, or if we make a too strong assumption, this single pairing assumption, if we make it too strong, then we run into the risk that it might be false, and then we haven't achieved much. So I guess the case can be made against interactive or oracle-based assumptions as being very strong in some sense. Or we can also assume that the pairing group is in some sense generic, which means that it's really opaque. One cannot really look into what's going on under the hood. We just have a few generic operations to work with, and that's it. If you assume that, that's of course an extremely strong assumption. All those assumptions I gave before follow. Actually, it's not even true, because subgroup, which is also based on factoring, would not even follow in that model. So there are a lot of subtleties when choosing assumptions. And so a sensible approach here is to prefer weak assumptions, but we should do with what we can. So here's a picture of the veil pairing. It shouldn't be taken too literally. It's not formal or anything, but the idea is that we have an elliptic curve defined over some field, over some base, some ground field here, and we have a group of points of prime order P, which is this set over here, and then we have some extension of some low embedding degree K of that. We have the same curve over an extension field. And for some particular value of the embedding degree, we have it turns out that we can find a subgroup that is isomorphic to ZP cross ZP. So when that happens, what happens is that if we are given two points in this subgroup, in this larger subgroup, we could notionally express them in terms of a fixed coordinate base. So since we have a two-dimensional space, we can pick an arbitrary coordinate system, U and V, and we can express any two points, Q1 and Q2, as having coordinates A, B, and C, D, according to this coordinate system. And what the veil pairing does is that it essentially computes this value over here, which is a piece root of unity, which exists in the extension field, to the power of the determinant of this matrix over here. And essentially, what it is that it raises this speed root of unity to the area of this parallelogram that I drew in red. And this picture is useful for cryptographers for the following reason. It tells you why it is bilinear, because obviously we have, since this parallelogram, the surface area will be linear in either of the coordinates q1 and q2. So if we double one, then we double the area. If we double both, then we quadruple the area. So it's bilinear, and it should also be hard to invert because we have something that appears in the exponent. It's just like it's the discrete log problem all over again in some sense. So this is a very informal way of explaining what the pairing does, but it captures what makes it interesting for crypto. And the magic of the Miller's algorithm is that this function can be computed just knowing q1 and q2, which without, of course, knowing those coordinates or even those imaginary coordinate systems, which would defeat the whole thing. So we can classify the types of pairings and the groups that they are constructed over in a few types. So the type one, where the two groups G and G prime, so G would be the base group and G prime would be some group that is not some or the P group that is not linearly dependent to it. So we can the pairing takes two arguments, Q1 and Q2, and Q1 leaves G and Q2 leaves in G prime. So in the type one case, we can have that G equals G prime. In that case, the DDH problem is always easy, which can be a good thing in some cases, can be a bad thing in other cases. And also another problem with this case is that it's not always that easy to achieve, and in particular it works for supersingular curves, but those do not scale well because the embedding degree is constrained. So another, in the type two, we can have the situation where we can map an efficiently computable homomorphism from one of those two groups into the other, but not in the reverse direction. So in that case, if we can go from G prime to G, where we assume that, for instance, G has a shorter representation, then DDH would be easy in G prime, which could also be a problem sometimes actually a feature, and this type of pairing often admits a shorter representation for elements of G. A problem that is encountered in practice, though, is that with the curves that I use to construct those pairings, it is sometimes difficult to hash into G prime. Now, a third type is that we can have a situation where we cannot map from one to the other. Of course, we can always do that, but that means we can do that efficiently. So in that case, DDH does not hold. We cannot compute DDH, even with the pairing. We can only compute a kind of a cross-group DDH, where some elements live in G and some elements live in G prime. And the problem with the type 3 pairings is that the absence of homomorphism sometimes hurts some proofs. And then there's the funny situation where we can define the pairing over a group of composite order, which has been used in the subgroup decision I mentioned earlier. So in picture, what does that all do? So in type one groups, for instance, on supersingular curves, what happens is that our group G would be the subgroup that we consider on the curve on the ground field. And then there's a nonlinear function psi, which is a homomorphism, and that we can apply to one of the two arguments of the pairing, if they are both given in G, to lift it into the bigger group, so that it no longer lives in G. So we can again have our parallelogram, whose area does not cancel to a zero area. So when that happens, when we have such a function, then we can set both arguments of the modified pairing to live in the base group, and we can apply our function psi to one of them, and then we have a symmetric pairing. Now in type 2 and 3, what happens is that we have to explicitly pick G prime to be a p-order subgroup that is orthogonal to the group G, and since we cannot map explicitly one G to G prime, we have to pick G prime explicitly. In that case, you have an asymmetric pairing. And an advantage of this case is that it is more general, but it is less powerful because it doesn't provide a DDH oracle in G1, for instance, and it also involves more notation. In the composite order, we can have the same. Schema where, in fact, where here the group orders would actually be a product of two primes, for instance. This is used for the subgroup assumption I mentioned earlier. So that's kind of some background on the different types of bilinear pairings that one may that one can encounter. So now, what can we do with that in the context of identity-based encryption? So formally, identity-based encryption is this. We have four algorithms. We have a setup algorithm that is run by the key server that generates system parameters, and then we can have an encryption function that Alice can use to synthesize the text, and we can have a key issuance function that Bob can use after authentication to obtain his private key, and we have a decryption function to decrypt the ciphertext. So the what makes a scheme an identity-based encryption scheme is this key issuance function, which is sometimes called extract. So again, from a practitioner's point of view, IBE, well, we can do. It doesn't have to be encryption. It could be full encryption, or it could be an identity-based key encapsulation scheme, or an identity-based key exchange scheme. So full encryption is the most flexible, but when it's a black box, we can use it as a black box, but also it can waste some bandwidth if it's hybrid. Key encapsulation is perhaps a neater or cleaner primitive, but it involves many different layers, up to three layers if we are in the multi-recipient case. And then there are special applications of key exchange, where we have two parties that try to agree on the same key, but then we can run some problems if we try to do cross-domain operation. I guess Nigel will be talking to us later today about ID-based key exchange. I'm not going to talk about that at all, and I will actually focus on the full encryption case. So, towards our goal getting IBE to work in practice, we need to consider what type of algorithms they are. So again, we can have a classification of the non-IBE schemes, and in the pairing world, there are really three main broad categories. So there's the full domain hash category, which is the Bonnet-Franklin scheme, where that crucially relies on the identity being hashed in a random or local way onto a point on the curve. Then this the approach which I call exponent inversion, which involves taking an exponent, which is we publish g to the x, and x will be a secret known by the key authority. It doesn't want to reveal it to anybody, but it still can reveal g to the 1 over x or something similar to it to each user with a little with some twist, and the pairing will be able to perform the cancellation without even the user to recover x. And then the approach of commutative blinding, which is a little funny in the sense that it's kind of L-gamma-L encryption but done twice, where the pairing allows us to move things around. I will actually show you how all those things work. So in the Bonnet-Franklin scheme, the idea is that we want, say, we want the encryptor and the decryptor to agree on a session key, which can be used, so that will be a session key for a cam, and that can be used to encrypt a message. The way this is done is that it's really an L-gamma-n encryption, where there's a random exponent chosen by the encryptor that is used for blinding, but we have this h to the id, which is this random oracle hash I was talking about, that is paired with some public value g to the x, and the reason why this is an identity-based scheme is that so this h to the id, everybody can compute it, and we have g to the x, which is public, but to decrypt, what the encryptor publishes, it publishes g to the r, and from that, since the decryptor doesn't know r, I mean the adversary doesn't know r, it couldn't really do anything about it. But the decryptor will be able to unblind the thing, because he is given h to the id, again, to the x, where x is the secret, the master secret. And so what happens is that those things, so essentially the x and the r move around within the pairing, and the two things are equal. So that's the original idea of the Bonnet-Franklin IBE. Now with the exponent inversion, here's the basic Sakai-Kazahar scheme. It is kind of similar, and it's kind of not. It is similar in the structure. So the structure of the scheme is very similar. So if I move the slides back and forth, you can see that it's really the same thing, except that instead of hashing the identity onto a point on the curve, what we do is that we have this this inverse, this exponent inverse in the this inverse in the exponent, where h of the id is now an integer, and the hope is that nobody can retrieve retrieve this particular value. So this particular value is in fact the whole thing is unpredictable for somebody who doesn't know x. And now the blinding is done a little bit differently, but again the idea is that you want to the encryptor will arrange things so that we have an x plus h to the id that appears in the exponent, and that will be cancelled, that can be only cancelled by the holder of the private key, because he has that as an inverse in the exponent. So that looks pretty innocuous change, but in fact the first scheme can be proven under the bilinear Diffie-Hellman assumption, which I recall again what it is, in the random oracle model. And the second scheme, to make the proof work, you need a much stronger assumption. And what it is that we need to give a lot of data to the adversary. We need to give as many points of data that the adversary can make key extraction queries in the attack model. And it turns out that just at Eurocrypt, there was an algorithm that was published that shows a generic attack on this type of assumption. It's really not an attack, because there was a generic bound on the complexity. But what it says is that with all this data that the adversary gets, it can actually run a generic. It can actually recover this value of x faster than just if it had to run a generic discrete log. And so that has that we need to take these kind of things into account when we compare IBE schemes for use in practice, because that will affect what kind of parameters we can choose, because we'll have to pick dimension the parameters slightly to pick larger groups, or make sure that our prime p does not succumb to this attack. So another scheme that is also based on the exponent inversion is Gentry's IBE. I will not go too much into detail here. It's a kind of a very nice idea where, in fact, that involves again an exponent and it's inverse in the private key, but where the blinding is actually done in the target group as opposed to the as opposed to the ground group. And it's again based on a similar type of assumptions, but it has a very nice proof of security, which the fact that you can do the blinding in the target group is actually quite helpful to prove nice security properties about this. Now the third type of pairing-based IB scheme that I want to talk about is this commutative blinding approach. This one is quite different from the other two in the sense that, the idea is that essentially we have an Engelmann encryption with two hints. We have a first hint, which is the regular hint, and then we have a second one, which depends on the identity. So the way this works is that there's a master secret, which is an exponent y, picked by the key generator, and we have this function of the identity, which is two points, which is this linear function of the identity that is used both by the key generator and by the encryptor to create a ciphertext. Now the key generator would actually take this master key and actually this is just an Engelmann encryption of the master key with a special form to account for this funny function of the identity. Now to encrypt a message, the encryptor would have to pick a random exponent, and what I mean by this commutative blinding is that all those elements that I highlighted here will actually move around in the decryption when we have to compute this ratio of two pairings, and they will all cancel with each other, and the private key is randomized, unlike the other schemes. So now we can complete the encryption the conventional way by we involve some public parameter. We have again the same exponent here, and since this g to the y is present here and we have g to the y in here, so this k1 will appear here, and that being under the ratio, this will cancel this part, and what we are left is that we are left with the message that we encrypted. But the important part is this commutative blinding that's happening because of this ratio of two pairings. So this scheme looks much more complicated than the previous ones, perhaps. One thing to realize, though, is that all the exponentiations for encryption are done to fixed bases. So V is constant, G is constant, A is constant, and B is constant. So all the exponentiations are done to fixed bases, which means that that do not even depend on the identity, which means that we can, with a little bit of pre-computation, this can be done really fast. Also, this ratio of two pairings is not really that bad because most of the work in computing a pairing is in Miller's algorithm in particular, is to compute this repeated sequence of doublings. And when we have a ratio and then a final exponentiation in some cases, and when we have a ratio of two pairings, the sequence of doubling will only need to do it once, and so and again the same holds for the final exponentiation. So this is really not too much more difficult than computing a single pairing. So even though this looks slow, in fact it's actually quite fast. So here's a 3,000-foot comparison. For the best approach to use in practice is that, well, it's not necessarily a clear case, but one thing that comes out is that the Bonnet Franklin, which was the first IB scheme that came about, is actually quite slow because it requires a pairing during the encryption and also this hash two point random oracle, which restricts the type of pairings that you can use. Then this whole category of schemes based on exponent inversion are nice and intuitive, but the problem is that they cannot be extended. They are very fast, but they cannot be extended. For instance, we cannot do threshold key generation, we cannot do hierarchies, we cannot do anything like that. And also another problem is that, as I mentioned earlier, we have this, since they rely on a stronger assumption, which gives a lot of data to the adversary, we need to make sure that we dimension the groups appropriately so that we will actually withstand the style of generic attacks. So we could rely on the generic bounds, we should feel good about that. but then we can that would make the system quite significantly slower, or we can try to avoid specifically the case of Cheon's attack, which would require to choose a group F, a group of over FQ with the subgroup G of prime order P, such that both P minus 1 over 2 and P plus 1 over 2 are either prime or essentially have a very large prime factor. And so that is not necessarily a simple thing. So we have a lot of constraint there. So generating parameters online for this type of schemes to withstand Cheon's attack might actually be a problem. But once we have the parameters, then we are in business. Now this approach, which is based on exponent on this commutative blinding, now on the other hand is very flexible. We can do a ton of things. We can have a hierarchy. We can have thresholds. We can extend it to have anonymity, and then actually we can have some sort of forward security. There's a lot of things that we can do with it. So again, it's not a clear-cut case, but when we choose an algorithm, an IBE algorithm, we want to take care of, we want to consider its security, so the model and the assumptions, but also its performance, but the performance with respect to the exact security. We want to take the actual bounds given in the proof into account to dimension the parameters correctly. And flexibility is also an issue. If we just want to do bare bones IBE, then perhaps this exponent inversion is fine. If we want to do something more fancy, like having forward security, then we need a time hierarchy. If we need a hierarchy, then we have to use something that supports it. And also there's the whole issue of choosing the right curve and the right pairing, and there we have a lot of choices to consider. Now, of course, the problem is that those choices are not standalone, but they interact with the choice of algorithms, because not all algorithms support all types of pairings. For instance, do we need fast curve generation? If we do, then perhaps super singular curves would be good, but then we don't want half short element representation. Do we care about hashing? Especially, do we care about hashing into G prime? Well, then we cannot use type 2 curves. Do we care about homomorphism? If we do for the proof of security, then we cannot use type 3 curves. Do we care about DDH? Is it actually good? Is it going to hurt us? And is it going to help us? If it's going to hurt us, we cannot use type 1 curves. If it's going to help us, then we need to use type 1 curves. So there are a bunch of considerations to take into account. So about the need for speed, it turns out that in practice, it matters much more for encryption than for decryption. In the case of email, for instance, a single sender can put 10 recipients on the to list, but you only receive one message at a time. You only read one message at a time. So it makes sense that for individual users, that should be the case. Now, what about key issuance for IBE? Well, since we have a central server, then we have, of course, a bottleneck to be expected. This can be mitigated by this, for instance, by staggering the key expirations. I mentioned earlier that we want to have short-lived private keys by appending a timestamp on the key. And if you stagger those timestamps, then if Alice's week starts on Monday but Bob starts on Wednesday, what happens is that Alice will request her new key every Monday, and Bob will request his new key every Wednesday. So that provides some sort of balancing in a very natural way. Now, in reality, the systems are much more complicated than that. And that's where the part of the talk where I will switch towards a much more systemsy description of what IBE is when it is deployed, so that we have kind of reviewed what kind of algorithms we can use. So in a typical architecture, it could be the case that in a corporation here, we can have a client that does not have the software, IBE software installed. And the mail server will intercept that message, and depending on what the policy says, or the company's policy says, decide whether it should be included or not. So we have an additional component here already. And on the recipient side, you can have a bunch of of decryption, and on the sender side, we can also have a bunch of senders, some equipped with the software, some communicating directly with the internet, and then we have mobile devices and things like that. And the way this works is that so the critical features of such an architecture is that it is important to have to be able to enable cross-domain communication, and that's the case. Something that where we can build on the strength of PKI where it is strong, and provide IB where PKI fails us. I will get more into that later. And also, there's this issue of policy-based mandatory encryption. So, in the example, in the graph I just showed, it may be useful in a corporate environment to mandate encryption of all outgoing messages or all outgoing messages to a particular domain or something like that from all users, regardless they explicitly requested it or not. Then we also have this issue of a gateway decryption for incoming messages, for instance, for content scanning. And another feature that is quite popular is that of being able to decrypt encrypted message from anywhere, so that to provide an encryption service. And that's also a place where IB helps, because you don't need to store your private key. Your private key is if you can connect to the server of the company that provides you with the secure email, then you will be able to, over an SSL connection, will be able to do the decryption there. You can generate your key again on the spot. So for incoming content scanning with IBE, things are actually quite easy, because if an encrypted email arrives, it can transit through a gateway. The gateway can simply request the key of the user to the key server, decrypts the email, checks it for virus, whatever. We encrypt it for the recipient, and then there we go. Of course, we wouldn't want that for individuals, but for a corporate environment, this makes perfect sense. Now, in reverse, we have outgoing mandatory encryption. A user might compose a regular email, send it to the gateway that decides based on the policy what it should do with it, and if you need to encrypt it, it can do that quite easily. I mean, that would already be possible with PKI, but with IB things are simpler because this guy needs to know much fewer keys of potential recipients, so he only needs to know the public parameters of the domains. With whom the users of the internal network communicate or correspond with to the outside, as opposed to the individual public keys of everybody. So, and then we have this issue of cross-domain federation, which is the ability of two independent IB domains talking with each other. And that's where we can build on the strength of PKI. So the way this works is that we have two companies, alpha.com and bravo.com, and they have key servers with their secrets. Bravo would publish the public parameters over some website with an SSL certificate, over HTTPS, for instance. Then when Alice wants to send a message to Bob, the first thing that she needs to do is to, fetch the public parameters from Bravo over SSL, and then she can encrypt the message and send it to Bob. But when Bob gets it, he will do the regular authentication to get his private key if he doesn't have it already. So that's how IB works very nicely across domain. How many animations do I have on this slide? So another problem when deploying IB system is that one thing that I haven't addressed at all so far is the problem of user authentication. This is absolutely crucial. Since this guy can generate the keys for all the users in the system, it better authenticate the users properly. So the thing is that this is also true for PKI, but this is much less conspicuous in that case. For IB, this is really in your face. So IB by itself doesn't address this problem, but we can build on a whole layer of approaches that will solve this for us. And this is an old problem. There have been a lot of work done in this case, and it is not necessary to invent the wheel in this particular case. We can interact nicely with these techniques. So, in conclusion, I would say that IBE systems are very scalable because the key servers are stateless. There's no need to store certificates, especially there's no need to have a constantly increasing store of certificates. And same thing for private keys. And there's no need to manage revocation lists either. And they're also very easy to load balance because we can simply put two of them next to each other, and there's no need to really talk to each other. They can just work. And another advantage is that for backup and disaster recovery, it works quite well because the only thing that needs to be backed up is the master secret, really. But that never changes, or changes very, very rarely. So the master secret with all the configuration and whatnot would fit on a floppy or on some pieces of paper. We can put them in a safe and then forget about them. And it's the same regardless of the number of users in the system. And I guess I will stop here because I'm running out of time. Thank you.
Since you work at Voltage, which is marketing these things, can you tell us the kind of industry that seems especially interested in deploying these solutions?
Oh yes. So especially the demand seems to come a lot from compliance issues. So there's a bunch of legislation in the United States and elsewhere that require the use of encryption or some sort of security for communications. And so there's demand in the health sector or in banking, perhaps legal services, companies like that.
Are you pursuing implementation of other kinds of protocols based on pairings? Is this something like the application pairings? Is this really the main killer application, or the others more futuristic?
So that is the drawback in working to see what's happening in the industry in cryptography is that. There's in crypto research, you can think of a lot of new fancy schemes, and then in the industry, there's a lot of inertia in terms of acceptance and deployment. So, for instance, there's a lot of in the current stage, IBE is the only pairing-based protocol that we are using. For instance, for signatures, we use regular existing schemes. For signatures, the identity-based component seems to be much less helpful because you can send a certificate along with your identity, along with the signature. So there's no need for this round trip. It's for IBE that the pairing really provides something. But who knows what might happen.
A couple of times you mentioned one of the big advantages of IBE is that you don't need any revocation.
Right.
Does that limit the applications that you can use IBE if you go for that solution?
Actually, yes, there are cases where people would actually be very exigent in having the ability to revoke things the next microsecond. Well, then, that's... There are contradictory requirements, it's as much a problem of education as it is of cryptography, I would say. You can reduce the time frame at which the private keys expire, but you can only do it so much. If you use a too small time granularity, then what essentially will happen is that you will have one different private key per message, which would still be not as bad as if you are using regular technique, because you don't need to store all those private keys. You can still generate them on demand, especially if you use a hierarchical scheme. But with a forward secure hierarchical scheme, then you could implement that without having a lot of storage on either the server side or on the client side. But you would still have a much greater communication overhead.
Okay.